This is Marketplace Money from APM. I'm Tony Cox. It's time now for your letters. This week, I am happy to welcome Los Angeles Times consumer columnist David Lazarus to the studio. David, nice to see you.
Thank you, Tony.
And, you know, I want to say this truly. I am a big fan.
Get
of
out.
Your I'm telling you.
Oh, high praise indeed.
And in fact, I was checking out your column earlier in the week, and I read about a couple who ran into some trouble just before taking a major family vacation. Of course, you can tell the story better than I can. So what happened?
Well, this is one of those stories about whether trip insurance is a good idea. And in this case, it's an elderly couple. They do a lot of traveling. They buy trip insurance every time. And they were going to book a cruise from the Black Sea up to Romania, up the Danube. Sounds kind of fun. $12,000 worth of fun, though. That's a lot. And you want to protect your investment in a situation like that. And so they spent a little over $1,000 on trip insurance, which was offered through the cruise line, which is Grand Circle. And the trip insurance provider was Tripmate. All well and good so far. Now, what happened was, long and short, is the woman here had a flare-up of a condition that was similar to tuberculosis, coughing fits. She had to go to the doctor. She had medicines. The medicines kind of debilitated her. They had to cancel. So they contact the cruise line. The cruise line says, well, you're canceling a little bit before the trip. We can give you 60% of your ticket back. No harm, no foul. Great.
Okay.
The insurance should have covered the rest. And that's where they hit the roadblocks. The insurer first didn't contact them. Then when they contacted, the insurer said, well, we're going to deny your claim because we're not convinced you were getting treatment at the time of the cancellation. They appealed. The insurer denied the appeal for the same reasons. Then the couple came to me. I went banging at Tripmate's door and talked to some people who know people. And what do you know? They said, guess what? We'll pay the claim. But they said that it turns out that it wasn't because I was muscling them, but because they had received some last-minute information from the doctor, and so through the goodness of their heart, they were going to now approve it. The doctor says he didn't share any extra information, but, you know, all's well that ends well, I guess.
Well, what about people who don't have David Lazarus to make telephone calls for them? Is buying this kind of trip cancellation insurance, if that's what it's called, is it a good idea or is it like the extended warranty in the big box stores?
It's not like the extended warranty, and I don't recommend the extended warranty because by and large, you're really not getting anything extra. These devices are built to last, essentially, so you're not really getting more bang for the buck. But if you're spending $12,000 on a cruise, that is a very hefty investment, and there's a lot of variables. And if you have to cancel, the cancellation policies can be very strict. So in those cases, I think trip insurance can be a very good idea. But as with all things, read the fine print carefully. For example, almost all trip insurance policies have a pre-existing condition clause, whereby if you're canceling because of a pre-existing condition that was already there, they're not going to pay. Sometimes they'll waive the clause, sometimes they won't. It always pays to read the fine print and know exactly what your rights are.
Is this an isolated, unusual kind of case because of the affliction that this woman suffered, or is this a run-of-the-mill insurer doesn't want to pay?
You know, I got dozens of emails after this column ran, and a handful of people stepped up to say, I've had a great experience with insurers, including Tripmate, but I've heard from a lot of people who said they also had to run an obstacle course trying to get a fairly valid claim paid off. So I think it's an especially tricky business. I think trip insurers especially are going to require a whole lot of paperwork and a whole lot of supporting evidence if you're going to have to appeal a claim that was denied. But it's worth the effort, to be sure. And then if you don't get your way, well, I'm always here. And weigh it, too. I mean, not every trip merits insurance, but a lot of them will.
All right. Let's turn now to some callers.
Ready to rock.
All right. Let's do that. We have some listeners on the line who would like to talk to you, of course, David, about their personal finance problems. Liz joining us from Grand Rapids, Michigan. Hello, Liz.
Hi there.
How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm great. I understand you have something that we should be congratulating you about.
Oh.
Yes, I'm told that Liz is about to do some serious moving and shaking in her company. Yeah, she's been working for a few years there. You're only, I know we're not supposed to talk about a woman's age, but you're 27. That's okay, right?
Yeah, okay. That's okay.
So some big changes are ahead for you. What's up?
Yeah, the company I've been working with, I've been there about 4 years now. Started at a very entry-level position, and I'm just about to come up on a promotion. So I've talked a bit with my superiors about it, so, you know, aware that it's happening. But as far as, like, the offer for the position hasn't happened yet. This is my first job out of college, so I haven't had any experience really as far as negotiating, you know, salaries or any of that kind of thing. And looking for, I guess, some advice as far as salary negotiations. What kind of questions are okay to ask? Good place to start? I mean, is it typical when you're in a company to be moving up to at a promotion point? Is that, you know, a negotiating point? So just where's a good place to start from? What can I expect?
You know, first of all, congratulations. It's very
Thank
cool
you.
That you're starting to climb your way up the corporate food chain. That's a
yeah,
good thing.
Yeah.
Now, you know, the long and the short of it is if you're going into any job interview where you're trying to make an impression, what you want to do is convey what you can do for the company as opposed to what the company can do for you. It sounds simple, but a lot of people, they come in and obviously, you know, we're all thinking about numero uno in a situation like this. And you're thinking, what's the salary going to be? What are the benefits going to be? How much vacation time am I going to get? That's what you're obsessing about. That's
right.
Exactly not where you want to start. What you're going to want to be starting with is what you're going to bring to the table. That's what the employer wants to hear. And since you're coming in from a relative position of strength, they know you. They know what you can do. They're interested already, which puts you far ahead of the game as it is. So what you come into the room needing to do is list your accomplishments, list all the achievements you've had, and list your goals for the future. That's catnip to an employer. They want to hear that kind of thing. They want to know that this is how Liz is going to step up her game and bring more value to the company, more value to shareholders, and then we'll talk about more value to Liz. And I'm guessing that's where you want to go with this conversation, right?
Maybe, potentially.
Liz, I have a question for you.
Sure.
Because this is something that I think always comes in negotiations in terms of your deciding what your personal bottom line is. So let me ask it this way. Are you ready, Liz, to walk away from the position if your requests are not met?
Ooh, I guess I haven't really thought about that.
What about that, David? Should she be thinking along those lines or not?
Well, obviously, anytime you've got teeth in negotiations, that gives you a stronger hand. But, you know, let's be realistic. Look at the unemployment rate out there. Not a lot of people have that leverage anymore. Employers know this. They know that it is a buyer's market when it comes to staffing. And now, in your case, Liz, if you go in there saying, I have ideas of what my compensation should be relative to the responsibilities that I'm hoping you're going to give me. Again, always bring it back to that.
Sure.
And then also, you know, vacation time, for example, maybe you're not going to get 4 weeks. Maybe you're going to get 2 weeks with the understanding that it'll go to 3 weeks and then maybe four weeks down there. All good. You know, you're going to build up your equity in the company in that way.
Sure. Great.
Liz, congratulations again to you. Good luck, and let us know what happens, all right? Call us back.
Yeah, definitely.
We
appreciate Thanks so much
that.
For your help. I appreciate it.
Thank you for calling. We have another caller.
Good.
All right, this is Dale joining us from Fort Lauderdale, Florida. Dale, how are you?
Just fine. How are you?
Oh, fine. Is it nice and warm down there in Florida right now?
Oh, yes, it is.
Oh, that's a good thing. So what's your question, Dale, for David?
Well, my question is, for a lower-income single female, I'm looking to get out of renting and get into buying. What options do I have?
Do you have a steady income right now?
Oh, yes. I'm full-time employed, but my fiancé is not.
Okay. You know, it's tricky. You want to trade up. It sounds like you're at that point in your life where you're ready to put down some roots, start building, you know, for yourself, and that's great. You know, that's the quote-unquote American dream right there. So many people got into trouble in recent years because every lender and their cousin was offering these loans, these interest-only loans and all the rest, all these exotic instruments with no money down. And before you knew it, you were in over your head. And that's just not the way to play. You want to keep things simple. You want to keep things straightforward. And you want to make sure that you've got enough income to cover the nut. And so, you know, if you're a low-income person, what's really important here is to see if you can actually structure a loan that's going to work for you.
Tell us a little bit about your living situation right now. You're in an apartment, I'm assuming?
No, actually, it's an older mobile home, and it's, you know, that was living within our means. It was cash, so there's no mortgage, there's no property tax because, you know, you pay rent to the home office there. So that, I thought, was a lot better off than paying, you know, property taxes and all that other stuff on top of a mortgage with PMI and all that. I was just wondering, as far as like FHA or Fannie Mae, or what programs can I look into? Can I get into something like a Habitat home?
So you're renting in a mobile park right now. Would you mind telling us some idea of what your current rent is where you are?
It's $575 right now, but it keeps going up, and I don't see that it's going to stop going up ever.
As it happens, I know that the average rent in the Fort Lauderdale area is about $1,400 a month. That's rent on an apartment. So you're paying a fraction of that. If you were to buy a house, you would expect a monthly mortgage payment of at least $1,000 and probably north of that figure, depending on what kind of property you buy and in what neighborhood. So think about renter's assistance because it's out there. For instance, HUD offers rental assistance programs. There's a number of nonprofit organizations throughout the country that provide rental vouchers to low-income people. That's another way of doing it. There's always public housing, which is another factor as well. There are options out there. But I think rather than jumping from a trailer park to ownership of a home, you want to get an apartment first or a similar sort of thing as an intermediary and see if you can come up with a plan that'll make that work.
That's pretty good advice to sort of keep yourself thinking about the American dream, but making it a realistic dream that you can try to achieve. All right, Dale, good luck to you. Thank you for calling.
Thank you very much.
David, before you go, we're going to break the rules a little bit, okay? Follow me with this. I want to ask you about a question that involved me.
Oh, okay.
Okay.
Another caller, as it were.
You know, I'm a listener. I'm a talker, but I'm a listener also. I had an experience where a company that I pay a bill to monthly, and I'm an old school guy, I write a check, put it in the mail, put a stamp on it, send it off.
Oh, that is old school.
I know it's old school, and I know that everybody else is doing it online, but I still do this one the old way. And the problem is this. I send this check in well ahead of the due date. There is a grace period. But the company, for whatever reason, holds on to the check until the day after the grace period, posts the check, cashes the check, and then charges me a late fee.
Oh, that's just evil.
I called them on it, and I wasn't able to say I'm David Lazarus, but next time I call them, I'm going to say I'm a friend of David Lazarus. Here's what the explanation was that I got back. Well, it must have taken the post office 2 weeks to mail this from California to Pennsylvania. Now, that's crazy. I'm thinking, and you tell me if this is true, that companies are doing this kind of thing to try to force consumers like me into online bill paying.
Or just to sock you for the late fee.
Or sock me for the late fee.
Or both. I mean, first of all, this is a bit of an aberration. Not all businesses would be this underhanded in their dealing with a regular customer.
Right.
It sounds like this company, for whatever reason, doesn't know what the left hand and the right hand are doing, is what I'm guessing. And it's going to be a processing snafu. There is no reason whatsoever, though, that you should ever be in a situation where you sent the check in with plenty of time and they're still trying to get you with a late fee because they deposited the check late. What you want to do in that case is you call up customer service. You say, put on a supervisor, because the front line of customer service is not empowered to deal with situations
That's
like
true.
This. The key thing to emphasize is I am a customer in good standing. I mean, you're not some scofflaw. You're not somebody who's been bouncing checks right and left. You are somebody who's doing his job when it comes to being a good customer. It's the company's job now to step up and meet you halfway. I suspect they will. But that said, Tony, online banking.
It's okay.
Wake up and smell the 21st century, dude.
I mean, it's
online. Convenient, it's easy, and you know,
it
eliminates all the muss and fuss.
You're right. I just don't like being pushed to it. I want to go willingly.
Because it's your decision.
Yeah.
Right. And I'm respecting you for that.
Yeah, yeah.
So what you should do is decide right now that that's what you're going to do and avoid these problems in the future.
I love talking to you. David Lazarus is the business and consumer columnist for the LA Times. Thank you.
Thanks so much.